This is a CBC podcast. CBC Books is the home for Canadian book lovers. Enter contests, watch videos, and listen to CBC Radio 1's Writers and Company and The Next Chapter all in one place. CBC Books, where readers click. Go to cbc.ca/books.
From the Ohio Theater in Playhouse Square in Cleveland, Ohio, it's The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart MacLean.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're just as happy to be here. Well, the last time the Cleveland Indians won the World Series was the year that I was born, 1948. The Indians beat the Braves that October, the Boston Braves, and that was a series to remember. The only one in a decade that a team from New York City didn't win, the first series that was broadcast nationwide on television, and the first where a black pitcher took the mound. Satchel Paige, fifth game, 2/3 of an inning. And Satchel pitched for Cleveland. My friend Dale Topham was 3 that year. Like me, Dale grew up in Montreal. And like me, he came of age in the 50s and the 60s. And that means Dale and I share an understanding of the USA. Every Canadian boy of that era does. We followed baseball, but we followed it with a certain intellectual passion. We saved our emotions for hockey. And when it came to hockey, we pitied your teams. We loved American clothes, however. We schemed about how to get our hands on a pair of Lee jeans, and we loved American radio. Late at night, alone in our rooms, we listened to, well, my favorite was in Buffalo, WKBW, Joey Reynolds. Now, one difference between Dale and me was our relationship with Cleveland. He had one. Until recently, until WCPN started carrying the Vinyl Cafe, I didn't. So when Dale heard that I was coming here, he wrote to me. And when I read his letter, I asked him if I could read it on the radio. He said yes. Dear Stuart, like you, my first awareness of Cleveland was their baseball team. But the first thing from Cleveland that rocked my world literally did just that. Alan Freed was among the first DJs to play black R&B to white American youth. Broadcasting out of Cleveland, he called himself Moondog, and he called the music rock and roll. It stuck. As the popularity of his radio show increased, Freed expanded into concert promotion, starting with what many people call the first rock and roll show ever, the Moondog Coronation Ball. Yeah. It was held in the Cleveland Civic Auditorium in 1952. The 10,000-seat venue was oversold. Too many tickets had been printed. Fights ensued, and the show was closed after the opening act. That didn't stop Freed. He expanded beyond Cleveland. During the 50s, I attended his Show of Stars at the Montreal Forum. He brought me Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Jerry Lee Lewis, Clyde McFadder, Laverne Baker, Frankie Lyman, Fats Domino, The Platters, The Drifters, Paul Anka, The Everlys, Sam Cooke, and everyone else who had a hit. Like you, late at night, I used to tune in DJs like Freed, bouncing in on the skip from exotic American cities like Boston and Buffalo and Wheeling, West Virginia. I was just a kid under the covers with the tubes glowing in the dark. Alan Freed soon enough left Cleveland. He moved to New York City, where he had a finger on the pulse of any way to milk money from the music business. He often took songwriting credits for songs he had nothing to do with. Cash from record companies was standard operating procedure. In the early 60s, Freed was prosecuted in the Paola scandal and lost his job as a DJ. He died broke a few years later. His ashes were interred in a New York cemetery. This was around the time I got a summer job on a Great Lakes freighter, the summer of 1960. Cleveland was going to be the first American city I ever visited. I boarded the ship. Go ahead. I boarded the ship just before it cleared the St. Lambert Lock in Montreal. It was loaded with grain from the lakehead, and it was heading east. We delivered the grain to some large concrete elevators at Trois-Rivières, and then floated light downriver to Sept-Îles on the north shore of the Gulf. Once loaded with iron ore from Labrador, we headed back upriver into the St. Lawrence Seaway. I remember dusk falling as we wove silently through the Thousand Islands. We entered Lake Ontario in the black of night. When I awoke, the world had become gray pea soup. We were going dead slow with many different foghorns sounding at many odd intervals. We were trying to locate the mouth of the Welland Canal while avoiding collisions with other ships. Suddenly, the lighthouse on the pier jutting into Lake Ontario loomed out of the fog right beside us. We were already in the canal. We passed under the ghostly Garden City Skyway, which was still under construction at the time. It took us a full day to climb Niagara Falls into Lake Erie. The next morning, a pair of tugs maneuvered us up an incredibly narrow and twisty river, past several drawbridges, to a dock in a barren industrial landscape. In the distance, I could see tall buildings. It was what I had been waiting for, the Cleveland skyline. It was a Sunday. The city was deserted. I left the ship and headed for the buildings. As I walked, I encountered few cars and no pedestrians. Nothing was open. I never even found a corner store where I might buy a Coke. After about an hour, I retraced my steps to the ship. I had gone looking for America and come up empty-handed. Back at the ship, a crew of longshoremen with their heavy equipment was extracting the iron ore from our holds. On Monday morning, the tugs dragged us back out into Lake Erie, and we headed for Superior to complete the cycle. It was 17 years before I passed through Cleveland again. I was returning to Vancouver from a visit with my folks in Montreal. I didn't see much more of Cleveland from the I-90 than I had on foot in 1960. But I was delighted to find that the freeway soared high over the little creek where the tugs had towed my ship all those years before. In 1995, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame opened its doors on the shores of Lake Erie, not far from the mouth of the river I sailed down that summer. Alan Freed was among the first wave of inductees. In baseball, Alan would have as much chance as Pete Rose of making the Hall of Fame. But this is rock and roll, folks. And characters like Alan Freed are heroic. From all reports, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has amassed an incredible collection of cultural history. And I'm glad you are finally making it to Cleveland, Stuart. I need to go back. I'd like to try to retrace my steps of 50 years ago, visit the Rock Hall, go to an Indians game, and search for the ghost of Alan Freed. Oh, he's there all right. On March 21st, 2002, Alan Freed's ashes were brought to Cleveland and reinterred in an undisclosed wall in the Hall of Fame. His marble marker from the New York cemetery was shipped with him. It hangs in the lobby, I'm told. Knowing a bit about the man, I suspect his ghost is indeed hanging around the lobby and has probably figured out some way to channel a percentage of the gate to a secret bank account. A bank in where else but Cleveland. Thanks so much. That was from Dale Topman. Dale grew up in Montreal, Quebec. He lives in Vancouver these days. So it's time now for me to introduce today's musical guests. He has toured with groups like Blue Rodeo, Bryan Adams, and Sarah McLachlan. He's released four albums of his own. Twice he's been nominated for a Juno, which is a big deal in Canada. That's like being nominated for a Grammy Award. He lost them both. But both times he lost to Neil Young, so in our books that's kind of like winning. She's just back from a North American tour with Sarah McLachlan, and she has three records under her belt. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Luke Doucette and Melissa McClellan.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
This is a love song of sorts. It's called Hey Now.
Hey Now, what are you hiding me from? Like me much, do they love? And hey now, well I couldn't leave if I wanted to. It's been snowing for days, there's nowhere I could be going to. Hey now, what are you hiding me from? It's way too dark up there. Sugar, sugar, don't you hide. I'm coming out. It's way too dark up there. Sugar, sugar, I made you an honest girl. Hey now, I couldn't lie if I wanted to. And hey now, why am I hiding under the bed? I've made so many mistakes, not one has gone to my head. Hey now, what are you hiding me from? 'Cause I'm coming out, it's way too dark up there. Sugar, sugar, don't you hide. I'm coming out. Way too dark up there. Sugar, sugar, don't you hide, don't you hide. Sugar, sugar, don't you hide, don't you hide.
Well, I should tell you a little bit of a story. I don't know if it's obvious to you or not, but Melissa and I are married. I celebrate that every day. But when we first started dating, before we had told our friends and families, I made a plan to go by her house, and the plan was that I would go in the evening and I would leave in the morning, but that she would borrow her roommate's car and drive me to the airport, Pearson Airport in Toronto, before either of her roommates, whose names were Ed and Sue, before they woke up. But overnight, there was a snowstorm, and it turns out that Sue was up in the morning when Melissa got up to borrow the car. And so she asked Sue, who I should mention is Melissa's mom, Ed, of course, being her dad, if she could borrow the car, and Sue said, "No, honey, there's been a snowstorm, it's not safe."
So I kept Luke up in my room for a very, very long time. And I fed him, and I watered him. And I kept him quiet for a good while, and then he finally said, "Come on, just introduce me to your parents."
Which, of course, inspired the song.
'Cause I'm coming out, it's way too dark up there. Sugar, sugar, don't you hide, don't you hide. I'm coming out, it's way too dark up there. Sugar, sugar, don't you hide, don't you hide.
Thank you.
Luke Doucette. That's off Luke's album, new album, Steel City Trawler. They'll be back. Well, it's time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this part works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true and they have to be short, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read all the stories you send us, and we promise we'll read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of our latest Vinyl Cafe book, The Vinyl Cafe Notebooks. Today's story comes from Bruce Burnham of New Limerick, Maine. "Dear Stuart," writes Bruce, "years ago, I was a U.S. border inspector at the Holton, Maine crossing, opposite Woodstock, New Brunswick. One of the old-time Canadian officers had the habit of walking over to our side to fill an old rum bottle at our water fountain. He claimed our well water tasted better. He was full of stories of his time working for Canada Customs, including many tales of the Prohibition days in the USA. One day, while we were discussing documents used to prove citizenship, he told me the following story. It took place, he said, in the 1930s or 40s, in the days before drug and alien smuggling, when the night shift was generally staffed by one man, valiantly trying to keep awake for the 8 hours of darkness. He told me about one morning, around 3 a.m., an old man stopped at the Woodstock port of entry seeking admission into Canada. He was scruffy and unshaven, driving a muddy old Model A Ford bearing New Brunswick license plates. He claimed to be vacationing at a camp on the Miramichi River. He said he had borrowed the car from the camp owner to drive to Holton, Maine on business the day before. My friend was naturally suspicious, considering the gentleman's appearance and his Canadian plates. To make matters worse, the old man claimed to have forgotten his wallet at the camp. He had no identification whatsoever. The officer told the man he couldn't enter the country. The old man then asked if the customs inspector had an American dollar bill. Customs inspector admitted to having one, but said he wasn't about to give it to him. But the old guy didn't want the bill. He asked for a paper and a pen instead, and then he signed his name. He gave his signature to the inspector and asked him to compare it to the one on the dollar bill. It was a perfect match. The old coot was the treasurer of the United States. And so the inspector waved him through, and he continued on to the salmon camp on the river, and they remained friends for many years. The story came to us from Bruce Burnham of New Limerick, Maine. We're going to get Luke and Melissa back up here to do another song now. They're going to do a song that Melissa wrote now.
Cinderella, same devil's gonna get you.
gasoline and burnt tires. She fled the scene like a wolverine from a forest fire. They found the chief in his Sunday breeze, the press armed with ink. The sheriff said they're probably dead. Now get yourself a drink.
Melissa McClellan. Yeah. Sure can sing. Yeah. It was spring. One of those glorious weeks when each morning seemed to be warmer than the morning before it. The sun shining down on the trees, on the garden, on the lawn, on all of creation, on every man, woman, child, dog, cat, and squirrel. Setting everyone and everything all a-tingling in the warmth of it and the light of it, and most of all, in the idea of it. The idea that it was warm today and, dear God, better yet, it was going to be warmer tomorrow. It was spring, and the world and everything in it was stretching and shedding, shaking and bursting, the whole kit and caboodle uncurling like a fiddlehead. It was spring. And for the second sweet day in a row, Morley was spending the day at home alone. She'd been planning this since February, 3 days by herself. Yesterday, she did her office, her bedroom, and the hall closet. Tomorrow, she'd attack the kitchen cabinets. She wasn't spring cleaning. She was weeding, sorting, packing, throwing out. She was giving her house a haircut. Today, she was doing the basement. They have shelves down there, and Morley had taken a cardboard box off the top shelf, not the first, one of many. That's what she was doing down there, going through things. Like all the other boxes she'd gone through before it, she had set this box from the top shelf on the floor beside her and flipped it open. It was full of stuff wrapped in tissue. It was a box of tissue packets. She had no idea what it was, a vagrant box of Christmas decorations, perhaps. But lying on top of all the little tissue packets was a doll. What? Said Morley. She picked the doll up, laid it aside, and picked up the top tissue package and unwrapped it. It was her girl guide shirt. She held it up. Could she have ever been that small? The second package was an old diary. The third, a pack of letters. She had, apparently, found a box of keepsakes. She had a vague memory of putting it away, sort of, maybe. But a doll? She unwrapped a few more things. The locket her father had given her on her 13th birthday. Her first driver's license. All these things made sense, except for the doll. She'd never seen the doll before in her life. And by that, I don't mean she had forgotten the doll. I mean she had absolutely no memory of it, none whatsoever. A doll, she said, again. It was a little odd. It's not that Morley didn't have any dolls as a little girl. She had dolls. Most girls have a doll or two. But in her box of keepsakes? Morley, you see, was never what you might call a girly girl. She lived on a street with a bunch of boys, and she learned pretty early on that if she was going to get any respect, she wasn't going to get it playing with dolls. Not that the boys on her street minded playing with her dolls. She had, for instance, one of the very early Ken and Barbies. Boys were always ready to play with them. They'd take Ken and pop off his head and exchange it with Barbies. Pretty early on, Morley learned to leave her dolls at home when she went out. Learned to be proud of her skinned knees and her messy hair. Morley's history with dolls was largely a tale of neglect. That this unknown doll had made it into her box of keepsakes made no sense to her. None at all. Strangely, her husband, Dave, had his own difficult experiences with dolls growing up. And I say strangely because it wasn't common in those days for a boy to have much to do with dolls at all. But Dave grew up in a small town, and he had a small sister. So it happened that he grew up with dolls all around him, which was not always easy. Because when Dave was a boy, dolls terrified him. None more than the baby doll his sister Annie got for Christmas the year of the big spring flood. It was a life-sized and disturbingly lifelike doll baby with a head that flopped around and a serious but largely vacant expression. Mostly this doll stared into space, unless you lay her down. When you put her down, her eyes closed. And Dave thought this was just creepy. The way its eyes slid open and closed, and the way they seemed to stare vacantly at you when they were open. He tried not to show it, but Annie, with the cruel and unerring sensibility of a sibling, figured it out almost immediately. Sensing a weakness, she set out to exploit it. The doll was named Rhoda. "Did you know," Annie said to her brother one night as they were getting ready for bed, "that when it gets dark, Rhoda comes alive?" Dave laughed. Dave said, "She's a doll, that's impossible." Dave said, "She does not come alive." Annie saw the flicker of doubt in his eyes. And Annie knew she had him. In fact, he had dreamed of just this, of Rhoda appearing in his room, clutching a knife in her evil little doll hands. "Yes, she does," says Annie. "And if you're not nice to me, she'll get you." Sure of herself, Annie began using the doll to torment him. She brought Rhoda everywhere. She'd buckle her into the back seat when they went in the car. She'd take her to the park and set her on the swings. Worst of all, she'd bring her to dinner. She set a place for Rhoda every night. Their mother, Margaret, thought it was sweet, and she played along until one night when they came back from a night of bridge. It was well past midnight when they got home, and when she went to check on Dave, she found him sitting up in his room, wide-eyed with terror. He was holding on to a baseball bat. "Rhoda's gonna hunt me down and kill me," he said. Margaret took one look at her pale son, his dark, smudged eyes, and she thought, "That boy hasn't slept in weeks." She told him that she'd throw the doll out. Annie was livid. She didn't particularly like Rhoda, but she liked the power Rhoda had conferred on her. No one was going to throw Rhoda out. She didn't care about her brother's fear. Like any good mother might, Margaret decided that she'd try to make both her children happy. And she hid Rhoda in the attic crawl space. She told Annie that she'd put Rhoda away in a safe place until Dave and Annie could get along. She told Dave she had thrown Rhoda out. "Did you throw her in the fire?" said Dave. "You have to burn her." "Yes," said Margaret. "I burned Rhoda. But don't tell your sister." 10 years went by. And one spring weekend, Dave, now a teenager, was given the task of cleaning the attic crawl space. He strapped one of his uncle's old mining lamps around his forehead and he squirmed in through the little door at the back of his parents' cupboard. He was knee-deep in insulation and old Christmas wrapping when his hand landed on Rhoda's leg. Rhoda rose out of the wrapping paper like she was rising from the dead, right into the light of Dave's lamp. And then, to underline her evilness, she batted her eyes open and closed, open and closed. Margaret heard his scream all the way downstairs. "Good heavens," she said, suddenly remembering the doll. She could hear her son tumbling down the stairs. "Rhoda's alive," he screamed. And he flew past her and right through the closed screen door. Everyone thought it was very funny. Everyone except Dave, of course. Dave didn't think it was funny at all. But he was old enough that he knew he would be expected to get over it. And Rhoda was returned to Annie's bedroom where she lived on her bookshelf, making occasional surprise appearances in Dave's room, dangling on a rope in his closet on Halloween. Tucked into his bed on graduation night. The year Dave turned 21, they went out for a family dinner at the Starlight Room in the Breakwater Hotel. It's just the family for dinner. But afterwards, some of Dave's friends joined them and there were presents. The highlight was when Annie gave him Rhoda. "Every man needs a woman in his life to keep in line," she said. And then she told the whole story. Before she sat down, she made Dave swear that he would never throw Rhoda out. They took a picture of him with Rhoda propped in a chair beside him. Propped in the chair because he refused to hold her. Dave didn't think it was funny at all. Of course, isn't it just the way of the world? Isn't it just the way things work? The Dave and Morley, both of them doll impaired, both of them wounded in their own way by dolls, would give birth to a little girl who was besotted with dolls. How was it that these two raised a little girl who had a room full of dolls? "There are Barbie and Ken stacked up in there like firewood," said Dave one day. "Where do they come from?" "I have no idea," said Morley. Both of them had no clue that their self-reliant daughter, who had figured out early on that she couldn't count on her parents to help her amass a doll collection, had developed strategies to do it herself. The most successful being a sleepover camp she advertised at school. Stephanie's classmates actually paid for the privilege of sending their dolls to spend 4 or 8 weeks in her bedroom camp. She promised they'd have loads of growth opportunities and lots of personal attention. Each doll that enrolled faithfully wrote at least one letter and one postcard home each session. "Please let me stay for 4 more weeks. I've made new friends and I'm having so much fun. It's such a bargain. I love you." By the time she was 8, Stephanie had amassed a collection of such proportions that she developed a complicated rotation system to manage their sleep privileges. She wanted to make sure each doll got an equal amount of time in bed with her. But all that was years ago. And now, all these years later, Morley was sitting on her basement floor, surrounded by tissue, staring at the doll that she had pulled out of her box of keepsakes. The doll perplexed her. That night, as they got ready for bed, Morley looked at Dave and said, "Am I forgetting things? Have you noticed anything?" She knew she hadn't lost her memory. She was worried that she was losing memories. More and more of her life seemed to be disappearing into the fog of time. And she didn't like that one bit. And so, a little perplexed, a little worried, a little discomforted, Morley did what she often does when faced with a problem she can't solve. She avoided it. She stuck the doll away in the top of the hall closet. It stayed there for months. It stayed there while spring was blown away by the great sigh of summer. And soon enough, it returned to what seemed like its lot in life. Soon enough, it was once again forgotten. Until a chilly October night, 3 a.m. Darker than dark. Hours from bedtime and hours from dawn. Dave couldn't sleep. He'd been staring at the ceiling for hours. Finally, he slipped out of bed and stumbled into the hall. There was a nightlight glowing in the bathroom. By the dull yellow glow of the nightlight, he opened the hall closet. He was looking for a hot water bottle. He reached up onto the top shelf. Later, when she'd tell the story, Morley would say the first thing she thought was that he'd had a heart attack. Except she always thought heart attacks were more silent, slumpy sort of things. Dave sounded more like, I was being attacked, said Dave. When Morley found him, he was lying on the hall floor, on his back. Rhoda was sitting on his chest, blinking. "Call the police," said Dave. "It's Rhoda. She's found me. Don't make any sudden movements." It was Dave who had put the doll in the box in the basement. "It's your doll?" said Morley. "I wanted her out of the way," said Dave. "I wanted her out of sight." None of them, not Morley, not Sam, and not Stephanie, none of them had heard the story about Rhoda. They have now. And there's a problem with sharing your great weaknesses with your family. Especially if your great weakness happens to be your fear of dolls. The problem is, your family will not likely offer you the level of sympathy or understanding that you believe you deserve. A week passed before Rhoda made her next appearance. A week passed. And one morning, Dave woke up and dressed and came down for breakfast. And there was Rhoda sitting at the table. "Ha ha," said Dave, "very funny." A week later, she tumbled out of his glove compartment. the thing about these things is, if they happen enough, they do lose their potency. The victim becomes desensitized. The joke loses its punch. So, in a way, the curse becomes the cure. Today, Rhoda sits on a shelf in Dave's store, just by the cash. And if you went in there ever and you asked him about her, he might, if he were in the mood, tell you the story, beginning at the beginning. But as likely as not, he'll just tell you that it's a doll that used to be his sister's. Morley, on the other hand, tells the story every chance she can get. And she always begins the same way. Did you know, she'll say, did you know that Dave's the only one in the family who plays with dolls anymore? If he's there when she does that, Dave always says, ha ha, very funny. Thank you. Come to the part of the show where it's time to say goodbye. I want to thank everyone here today, everyone who is in the theater, and everyone who's up here on stage with me. Dennis Pendrith on the bass. John Sheard on the piano. Luke Doucette and Melissa McClellan. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Matt Kineski and Ron Skinner were the recording engineers this week. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. And I'm Stuart McLean in Cleveland, Ohio. Melissa, sing us out now. So long for now.
Well, I walked through Cleveland till my feet were black. It only took 10 minutes, then I was back in this hotel room trying to write this song.
Met a little white man, he said he played guitar. His wife's in jail, and it broke my heart. Well, the stories you hear when you'd rather be left alone.
He said, roller coasting's what I do for fun. I buy two seats, but I only use one. The other I keep safe from my old girl. She gets out by Labor Day, and when she does, she's going away. We're gonna ride the rails back to Oklahoma. Back to Oklahoma. Well, the Cuyahoga River won't kill you no more. How they cleaned it up back in 74. Well, you might get sick, but welcome to Ohio. And it's the state that makes one the president, where Free Pete Rose is never dead. No, in 96 we shared an elevator back in Cincy. True story, very true. Roller coasting's what I do for fun. I buy two seats, but I only use one. The other I keep safe from my old girl. She gets out by Labor Day, and when she does, we're going away. We're gonna ride the rails up to Manitoba, back to Nova Scotia.
are tall, and long days in gray skies make sad folks of us all. Long days they stay, long days are tall, long days in gray skies make sad folks of us all. Long days they stay, long days are tall, long days in gray skies make sad folks of us all. Long days they stay, long days are tall, long days in gray skies make sad folks of us.
Black, it only took 10 minutes, then I was back in this hotel room.
Thank you.
Hello, you've been listening to The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. Over the next few months, Stuart McLean will be doing live Vinyl Cafe concerts in Clinton Township, Michigan, Bay City, Michigan, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, Windsor, Ontario, Milton and Burlington, Ontario, and St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. Check the website for all the details, vinylcafe.com.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.